First up is Massey versus Merrill Lynch, appeal number 05-3459. Mr. Price. I don't want you to think there's little interest in your case, but ordinarily the first case, the courtroom is crowded with a lot of people, and there's only eight people in the audience to hear your well, I'm sure will be brilliant arguments from both sides in this
case.
Well,
maybe everyone thinks it's a very easy question, Your Honor, so they're not here to hear the arguments. May it please the court, my name is Henry Price. I represent Jim Massey and Dennis Murray, the appellants and plaintiffs in this matter. The issue before the court can be simply stated: did the trial court err in dismissing plaintiff's amended complaint under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 12b-6 for lack of standing, citing the shareholder standing rule that prevents a shareholder from bringing a direct action for injury to the corporation? The answer to that question is yes, the trial court did err for several reasons. Of course, preliminarily, motions to dismiss are disfavored in the law and should be sustained only if plaintiffs could prove no set of facts under which they can recover under the allegations of the complaint. All the facts alleged are taken as true, all inferences taken in favor of the plaintiff.
How many different potential plaintiffs would there be if this case could proceed?
Well, Your Honor, there were nine members of the board of directors. So that is all
the stockholders.
I think the stockholders are not potential plaintiffs for the direct injury which we're alleging. The direct injury which we're alleging is the communications to the board of directors, both orally and in writing on April 6th, and the follow-up opinion. But it's the presentation to the board of directors that is a gravamen of our complaint. Some of those causes of action have expired by virtue of the statute of limitations. So the two that we have, the only two that we know of, are Murray and Massey.
And with respect to the plaintiffs that we have here, the representations made by Merrill Lynch were all made to them in their capacity as board members, right? Not as individual investors.
Well, they were made to them in a presentation to the board.
To the board. That's what I mean, as board members and not as individual investors. And so why should they be placed in a more favorable position than ordinary shareholders?
Well, because they did have these representations which were made to them, Judge Williams. They were members of the board. Merrill Lynch was an expert hired to advise the board on this transaction. Merrill Lynch made these verbal representations in the presentation of April 6th in a board book, which they handed out at that time, but which they took back and never returned, despite requests to do so. And that sets them apart. The individual, the shareholders to whom these representations were not made, we concede would have only a derivative cause of action based on the loss of value of the stock.
So, in other words, your position would be that corporate insiders who get special information could actually bring actions against third parties while ordinary shareholders could not. Well, that would be the ultimate consequence if we agreed with your position here.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, and I think that does not give the insiders an undue advantage. I think what it does is place the burden where the burden should be, which is on Merrill Lynch, the purported and self-declaimed expert in the field, to report their findings honestly, to not engage in fraud or reckless conduct in making these representations, both for the purpose of representing that the acquisition should be made, and also with the knowledge that, as was widespread at that time, many corporations in the country, including Conseco, had this directors and officers program in which the directors, officers, and key employees were encouraged by Conseco to purchase stock in order to enhance the image of the corporation in the financial community and with other shareholders. So I think it's the direct representation and the direct injury which they suffered because of the direct representation that does set them apart. And if it's described as giving them an advantage, I guess they have that advantage.
Well, the injury that you're claiming, counsel, is the diminution in the value of the stock, isn't it?
No, the injury we're claiming, Your Honor, is the fact that as participants in this directors and owners program, which Conseco devised, fostered, and Conseco controlled in buying, deciding when to buy the shares, deciding how many to buy, deciding the negotiations with the banks, actually paying the interest on the shares, we're claiming that now Conseco is seeking and suing Murray and Massey in federal court and state court for the value of those loans. That's the injury. The diminution in the stock only affects them in the sense it reduces their assets with which to pay this direct injury, if indeed the injury is held to be valid against them. We have many defenses, but they're right now we have to presume that they will be suffering this injury, and if they do, we believe that's the injury, not the reduction in the value of the stock. The reduction of the value of the stock merely reduces the amount of their assets with which to satisfy the injury.
But, of course, if we didn't have a decline in the stock price, you wouldn't have a claim.
Well, that's correct. If the stock price had not declined as a result of the misrepresentations of Merrill Lynch, as we allege, then we wouldn't have a claim because we would have sufficient funds with which to pay the debts which were incurred, assuming none of the defenses which we have under the program under which those debts were incurred are valid. Then we would have the money to pay them.
That sounds like a concession that the injury actually is the diminution right in the value of the stock.
Well, I think it is not, Your Honor. I think if Conseco had not, in the course of their bankruptcy, taken assignments, validly or not, entered into subrogation agreements, validly or not, with the banks and assumed this the obligation to collect these debts and gave the banks something, we don't know what yet, in return for them, then we would not have an injury. If these debts were not sought to be enforced, there would be no injury for which we would be seeking redress. It is the enforcement of these debts is the injury for which we are seeking redress from Merrill Lynch.
Well, would it make a difference if the plaintiffs had purchased their stock with cash rather than funds that they borrowed from Conseco?
Well, I think the funds that they borrowed in this D&O program makes it more clear that it is a separate and direct injury which are attributable to them. If they would have, let's just say there were no D&O program, and they went out on the open market after Merrill Lynch made these representations and bought stock.
Well, let's just assume there's a D&O program, but instead of being funded by loans from Conseco, it was a cash situation.
Well, I think that...
Where they just provided the cash. Because I'm trying to figure out how their injury is different from all the other shareholders.
Well, it's...
Go ahead.
Sure. It's different in our opinion, Your Honor, because of their participation in this intricate D&O program, which was the reason that they purchased the stock. Conseco urged the members of the board of directors and the
I understand that, and I'm just saying, let's assume the program was there and you had two options. You could either fund it by a loan, or if you had the cash on hand, you could just pay for it.
Yes, and if you had the cash...
And if you had the cash on hand, wouldn't they be in the same... I mean, to me, yes. The only difference is here it was a loan they took from Conseco versus, you know, cash that other shareholders would buy their shares on the open market.
That's the difference in acquiring it. There would be no difference in direct response to your question, Judge Williams. There would be no difference if they paid cash for the shares. They would still have the cause of action against Merrill Lynch because Merrill Lynch made these reckless, categorical representations to them personally, and under the laws of Indiana as interpreted by the Indiana Supreme Court and the Seventh Circuit, in Ashland Oil and Ackerman, it is these direct representations which give them an independent injury. And enforcing these this injury would be the same whether they paid cash or whether they borrowed the money.
Well,
still happens in this instance.
That's an independent injury, though. If everybody who owned Conseco stock suffered a loss here, a significant loss when the value plunged, why isn't everybody in the same boat?
Well, the difference, Judge Evans, is that they purchased this stock, whether it was by loan or for cash, in reliance upon Merrill Lynch's misrepresentations. The other shareholders did not do that. The other shareholders did not receive the representations verbally and in the briefing book that these individuals did. And so, therefore, the other shareholders could not claim reliance on Merrill Lynch in terms of their misrepresentations. Merrill Lynch attempted to disclaim, and I'm sure that's one of the things you'll hear, they attempted to disclaim in their formal letter that they really did anything at all, that they really said anything at all, that they made any investigation at all, that they offered any opinions at all that anybody could rely on. Of course, they were paid $22 million for their efforts, but it is the difference is these people received the misrepresentations. The rest of the people received only the information in the letter, and the information in the letter, they purport to disclaim everything and say shareholders, absolutely, they say explicitly, shareholders can't rely on it.
Yeah, so, but, you know, if we agree with you, here you have people sitting on the board. They're the most well-informed. And so don't we create a situation where they are the most well-informed, they get the assessment, and they would get the greatest financial protection, you know, they over regular shareholders in the event that there were bad results?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, I think that's problematic.
Well, Your Honor, it may not be...
So in other words, they would be ahead in the recovery line of everybody else, and they had this insider information.
Well, they had the information that was false as provided by
yes,
Merrill Lynch.
But, I mean, they had it, and it is not insider information in the negative sense, but they had information that nobody else had.
That's correct.
Because they were privy to it because they were on the board.
That's correct. And it's not that they'll be ahead in the line. It's just that they have – the law gives them, because of this representation, an independent cause of action against Merrill Lynch that the other shareholders don't have. I see – my white light is on. I would like to save 3 minutes so that if the court has no additional questions at this time, I will save 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Markle.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Gregory Markell. I'm with Cadwalader, Wickersham and Taft, and I represent Merrill Lynch in this action. I think that the panel has asked a number of questions that I myself have about this case. But I think the essence here is that this is a derivative action. This is truly a derivative action. And it's an action that, if it were to be brought at all, should have been brought by the corporation or in bankruptcy by the trustee. If there was a claim of improper conduct by Merrill Lynch, the trustee should have brought it, or the corporation, before it went into bankruptcy, should have brought it. And there is no such claim. But that is the nature of the injury here. The injury is, if any, to the corporation. And what is the injury? This company, Conseco, acquired for a very large amount of money, $7 billion, a company called GreenTree. Now, if there is some injury here, the injury results from that transaction, and the injury is to Canseco. It is true that if a company makes a very bad business decision, and makes a very bad acquisition, that is going to affect its stock price. It is going to affect its stock price. And that bad decision will ultimately, derivatively, have an effect on the shareholders. That's where the derivative comes from. Derivatively, it affects the shareholders. It is not, however, a claim, a direct claim. The injury here flows from a bad business decision.
Well, does the fact that Merrill Lynch allegedly made these representations directly to the plaintiffs, do you think that changes the nature of the claim?
No, Your Honor, and I think that there are several reasons. One, I think Your Honor had some good questions here. First of all, I will get to the disclaimers in a moment, but to the extent that these board members had information that the other shareholders didn't, and now we're talking a priori, before we know it's bad information, theoretically, then they're trading on inside information. The director shouldn't be trading on information that the other shareholders have. Those directors have a fiduciary duty not to trade on inside information. They should not be trading on information that the other shareholders have. That's number one. Number two, in response to your question, it's very clear from the opinion itself that the opinion is for the use of and benefit of the board of directors, sitting as directors. And if you look at the Collins case and the Kagan case that we have cited, where information is imparted to directors, sitting as directors, not as individuals, then that information is being passed for the benefit of the company and the board, not for those people sitting as individuals. They should not be trading on that information. That's the company's information. But the opinion letter goes on to say, and if, with your permission, I will read from the opinion letter. Our opinion addresses only the financial fairness of the exchange ratio and does not address the merits of the underlying decision to engage in the merger and does not constitute a recommendation to any shareholder, that all those public shareholders and the shareholders on the board are both shareholders within any shareholders, does not constitute a recommendation to any shareholder as to how such shareholder should vote on the proposed merger or any matter related thereto. Merrill Lynch was telling the board, we're advising the board. And I think it's important to understand Merrill Lynch's role here. They did get paid a lot of money. But what was their role? They made it very clear, in another section of the opinion, that they were not going to examine the value of GreenTree. That wasn't their job. It may have been the accountant's job. It may have been management's at Canseco's job. What Merrill Lynch was saying is our job, we've assumed what the value of these assets are. We've assumed that the financial statements are correct. That's what their opinion says. If that's true, if the financial statements are right, if the assets are stated correctly, if the liabilities are stated correctly, if the P&L is stated correctly, if all those things are true, then the exchange ratio for this merger transaction is fair. That's what the opinion says. It's quoted at length at page 10 of our brief. It says, just to take an excerpt, Merrill Lynch has not assumed responsibility for independently verifying such information or undertaken any independent evaluation or appraisal of any of the assets or liability. We're not an expert in the evaluation of allowances for credit losses or loan losses in the valuation of residual interest in securitized transactions. Now, what does that mean? These GreenTree had these complicated securitized securities. They had five different layers. The riskiest layer is called an IO, an interest-only security. That was what was in GreenTree's portfolio. The accountants valued it. GreenTree valued it. The company valued it. With all due respect, Mr. Price's clients valued it if they were doing their job as directors. They placed a value in whether this was a good business transaction. What Merrill Lynch told the board was not, we're saying this is a good business transaction. We're not telling you you should do this business transaction. We're telling you that if all the data that you're giving us is correct, based on market values out there in the marketplace, based on this company having this profit and loss and this asset and liability, and this company having this P&L and this profit and loss, the terms of the merger are fair based on market prices today. That's what Merrill Lynch said it was doing in its opinion letter. That was its role. And I know, and I think this is important, I have no desire that Mr. Price's clients be injured, but they've come to the wrong person to be made whole. They also brought claims against Price Waterhouse in this very same court, and those claims have not been dismissed at this point.
That's in state court, isn't it?
Yes, not in this court here. I'm sorry.
State court.
I'm sorry. You're right. It's in state court in Indiana, but they have brought those claims. Those claims have not been dismissed. Price Waterhouse actually, presumably in their audits, got into the assets and liabilities. They looked at those things, and according to the complaint that Mr. Price has filed against Price Waterhouse, they were making representations directly to his clients. Merrill Lynch, in writing, made it clear they were not making representations to his clients. They were making representations to the board, to the company. And if the company has a claim, they could have brought it. And they had two chances. The company, before it went into bankruptcy, had a chance to bring a claim. And then it went into bankruptcy, and a trustee could have brought the claim. We all know what trustees are like. If they thought Merrill Lynch had done something wrong, they could have brought that claim for the benefit of all shareholders, not someone trading on inside information. And the fact of the matter is they didn't bring that claim. That was an option for them. Merrill Lynch did nothing wrong, but more importantly, there is no standing here. There simply is no standing for these plaintiffs to bring this claim against Merrill Lynch. Even if you reversed the lower court on that opinion, even if you did, the claims are grossly defective anyway, right? And I will just very briefly state that. It's in our brief. Number one, the breach of fiduciary duty claim is barred by the statute of limitations. Number two, there is no fiduciary relationship. It's clear from the language of the letter that weren't making any representations to these people as individuals. Where the fiduciary relationship comes from is just completely missing. If on the fraud claim, this is a totally defective fraud claim. There's no indication what the misrepresentation is. They completely failed to plead it appropriately under 9B. There's a disclaimer that specifically bars this type of fraud claim. It is a totally defective claim, even if you get past the standing issue. Thank you for your patience, Your Honors.
Couple of minutes.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You got a couple of minutes.
2.5. Thank you very much. I would like to just briefly address the issue of whether or not this alleged insider information has anything to do with this case, which it doesn't. That if there is insider trading, the SEC will prosecute that, would have prosecuted it, it doesn't. There's no standing on the part of Merrill Lynch to make some kind of claim about insider trading. With respect to this disclaimer, this court has held in the Ashland Oil case specifically that such a disclaimer is not valid to relieve the party of participation in fraud. And it says a disclaimer cannot relieve, and it was accountant in this case, cannot relieve an accountant from a duty to refrain from knowingly being a party to fraud. That's what we've alleged, that they knowingly were a party to fraud. And a disclaimer which they issue in which they say we're not making any representations whatsoever except if the price of one company is a dollar and the price of another company is a half a dollar, then the exchange ratio of how many shares go from one company to another is fair. Well, what's that, a mathematical calculation for which they get $22 million? I don't think so. This court has said the optimal amount of permissible fraud is zero. And that's what we are asking this court to enforce, that if there was fraud made, if there were fraudulent misrepresentations made, if they were reckless, if they made categorical statements after having represented that they had significant expertise, then we are asking this court to reverse the district court, put us on our burden of proof, let us go get our evidence, let us come to before a jury or a judge and see if we can prove our case, but not throw it out on some misapprehension that this is the same as a derivative claim, which defendants suggest. It is not a derivative claim. It is a claim based entirely.
What was the alleged fraud?
The alleged fraud?
The alleged misrepresentation.
Fraud is, I'm sorry. The alleged fraud is specifically spelled out in our complaint, Your Honor, and they made unqualified statements at the April 6th hearing. David Sherwood advised GreenTree acquisition would be a very favorable transaction. Merrill Lynch purported to have completely and expertly examined the operations of GreenTree to determine the viability of its business model, the value of its assets, the availability of financial wherewithal to operate the business of GreenTree on an ongoing basis, the managerial ability available for GreenTree's operations to determine whether, in fact, there were adequate combined employee capabilities with which to successfully operate the business. That's alleged in our complaint, paragraph 44, so that there were specific representations made on which fraud can be predicated, and we are asking this court to give us an opportunity to do so. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we proceed to